But take it from me. No one knows the biz like I know the biz. I love the biz. Hollywood's a crazy biz, and I know the biz because the biz is in my blood. Some say I'm a biz whiz. Either way, show business is my business, so you better get busy with the business I know. Here are some inside thoughts and feelings from my years on set. I've had the privilege and the pleasure of wearing many hats, and because of that, my head is sweaty with all the knowledge I have about the biz. I may also have a fancy form of Hollywood lice. Anyway, here is what they won't tell you. The actor. Acting is the best. When things go well, you get the most credit. If you're in a great film or a play, everyone just assumes you did it on your own. Your face becomes a symbol for all things good and cool. Athletes nod at you. People interview you and describe in great detail how you entered a room. Acting lets you escape the real world and make out with people you are not married to. It lets you live in the skin of another person and run away from the person you actually are. Sometimes it heals old wounds and helps you discover something new about yourself. At its best, it's a true form of communication, and your performance changes lives and minds and gender roles and the core temperature of Mother Earth. But here's what no one in the biz will tell you. When you're the actor, you have little control. You audition for parts and deal with constant rejection. On set, everyone sits behind a monitor and whispers when you don't get it right. Your attractive yet interesting face better be shine-free and symmetrical as you try to remember your lines and blocking. Also, acting is embarrassing. I know this because Ted Danson told me. I was shooting a Beastie Boys music video with him, and I spent an hour or so talking to Ted and his gently divine wife, Mary Steenburgen. The rest of the day was spent mentally high-fiving my teenage self for getting to talk to Sam Malone and the late, great MCA. MCA, with the power of Buddha's compassion, may you be reborn swiftly into heaven's realm. The scene required us to all pretend we were scared of the Beastie Boys as they crashed through the window, and one by one we mugged into the lens as the camera rolled. Ted leaned over to me and said, "Acting is so embarrassing, isn't it?" I knew what he meant. It ain't easy to get up in front of people and really go for it. Good actors make acting look easy, which means most people think they can do it. Most people can't. I tell this story because I want to be honest about the biz. I also tell this story because I'm an actor, and actors are allowed to take up everyone's time and tell long stories while other people stand around quietly fuming. Especially the writer. The writer. Writing is the best. The writer has the real power. You can create something and the world will be forever indebted to and dependent on you. You feel like the smartest person around, especially next to all those stupid actors. People quote your own lines back to you like a rock star. You invent stories and characters that will live on long after you are dead. When you're a writer, you can work from home, live anywhere, and not have to lift things. The writer gets to decide who says what, when, and which way. But here's what no one in the biz will tell you. Writing can be thankless. People treat writing like it's some elegant act, but it's usually lonely and isolating. You will struggle over a piece of writing and then get to set, and some dumb actor will say it wrong or immediately want to change it. A writer needs to defend their words every day on set, especially since most of the people on set don't give a shit who the writer is, except for one person, the head honcho, the director. The director. Directing rules. You answer questions and save the day. Everyone needs a captain, and a good director knows how to steady the ship. You can cast your friends and hold auditions while wearing comfortable shoes. Each department needs you in a different way. You get to wear headphones and drink coffee while you share dirty jokes with Eddie from props. You also get to talk to actors like you're their parent, coach, and lover. A good director knows how to clean up messes. They decide when the day is done and whether or not we got it. Sometimes they get to have sex with an actor or actress, or at least their assistant. Directing is the most powerful job on any set. But here's what no one in the biz will tell you. Directing is a headache. You have to think of everything all the time. It's your fault if a stunt goes wrong. Directors are left cleaning up after the party, sitting around and editing the goddamn thing after everyone else has moved on. Actors can blame a director for not pulling a great performance out of them, but A director can only blame themselves if they cast the wrong actor. Most times, the director is a gun for hire, uniquely beholden to one woman or man. The producer. The producer. Producing is the goal. Producing is the shit. Producing is when you get to actually be in charge and apply all the things you know. The producer is above the fray. You get to visit set in your own expensive clothes and then take everyone out to dinner. Then you don't have to visit again until the 100th episode, when you hold that knife and cut that cake. The producer creates, orchestrates, and most importantly, makes that paper. Being a producer means you have the most connections and you've done your time in the trenches. It's the difference between staff sergeant and lieutenant general. But here's what they don't tell you. Producing is exhausting. If you're any good, you have many projects going on at once, and they are each on the verge of falling apart. You are the only one who knows how dangerously close all of them are to immolating, but you have to spend time on the phone making actors and writers and directors feel better. You have to hear every single one of those jerks tell you how they want to make something really special. You are the only one who might lose money. You aren't as young and cute as the actor. You've only met the writer once, so it's the director you depend on. And you didn't even want this stupid director in the first place. But he directed Dog President, and it made $100 million domestic, so the studio made a big push for him. Either way, the biz is amazing, and Hollywood will live forever.
Sometimes I worry that not enough people hate me.
Time travel. My thoughts on time travel are simple. It exists, and we are in control of it. I'm no scientist. I barely made it through my relatively easy college class entitled Physics for the Curious. Our final was a multiple choice test, and the answers spelled out Physics for the Curious. I didn't notice the pattern and got a C. Turns out I just wasn't curious enough. The only thing we can depend on in life is that everything changes. The seasons, our partners, what we want and need. We hold hands with our high school friends and swear to never lose touch, and then we do. We scrape ice off of our cars and feel like winter will never end, and it does. We stand in the bathroom and look at our face and say, "Stop getting old, face. I command you." And it doesn't listen. Change is the only constant. Your ability to navigate and tolerate change and its painful uncomfortableness directly correlates to your happiness and general well-being. See what I just did there? I saved you thousands of dollars on self-help books. If you can surf your life rather than plant your feet, you will be happier. Maybe I should have called this book Surf Your Life. The cover would feature a picture of me on a giant wave wearing a wizard hat. I wonder if it's too late. I'll make a call. So, change happens and time passes. And if you hate your stupid, boring town and can't wait to get out of there and show everybody what a kick-ass breakdancer you are, then this is good news. If you get really good at breakdancing and then realize nobody gives a shit about breakdancing anymore, this news is bad. Time moves too slow or too fast. But I know a secret. You can control time. You can stop it or stretch it or loop it around. You can travel back and forth by living in the moment and paying attention. Time can be your bitch if you just let go of the next and the before. I believe you can time travel three different ways, with people, places, and things. In the winter of 1997, the Upright Citizens Brigade was asked by High Times magazine to be judges at their world-famous Cannabis Cup. This was a high honor. Perfect pun. You're welcome. Before we took off for the Netherlands, a High Times interviewer sat down with us for a few hours and then realized he had never turned his tape recorder on. Heady days. So, we arrived in cold and wet Amsterdam, ready to sample marijuana from all over the world and finally settle the long-standing debate of whether or not Purple Kush is superior to White Rhino. As soon as we got to the venue, people started giving us weed, bags of it, pillowcases filled with it. An amount that would have taken any man or woman down. We were much more concerned about rehearsing our sketches, Matt Besser had written out a running order with cues that the lighting technician should follow. We were going over it when we were told the UCB would be opening for Patti Smith. Totally great pairing. Our show was pretty bad. A supremely stoned audience isn't the best audience for comedy, and our lighting technician lost our cue sheet before we went on. He literally lost it on the walk to the booth. Right before we were introduced, he came up and said, "Bad news, guys, I lost that list you made for me." Then he handed us a sleeping bag full of pot. Patti Smith was amazing. She talked about politics and sang like a soldier. She was so cool and interesting. She stomped around and spit on stage. Spitting is disgusting, but when Patti spits, it looks like ballet. Fun fact, Seth Meyers was in the audience that night. He was living in Amsterdam and performing with a group called Boom Chicago. It would be 4 more years before we would officially meet and instantly become friends for life. Do you think it's a coincidence that Seth was in the audience again during another seminal night for me? I don't. People help you time travel. People work around you and next to you, and the universe waits for the perfect time to whisper in your ear, "Look this way." There's someone in your life right now who may end up being your enemy, your wife, or your boss. Lift up your head and you may notice. As I watched Patti perform, I took a mental picture of the moment and I looked around and I thought about my life. I felt grateful. I noticed every detail. And that is the key to time travel. You can only move if you are actually in the moment. You have to be where you are to get where you need to go. Cut to 2013. I'm at a restaurant in Los Angeles and Patti Smith comes out of the bathroom. I freeze. And then I say, "Ms. Smith, my name is Amy Poehler, and my group opened for you in Amsterdam in the late 90s. She was very nice and polite and pretended to remember. Maybe she did. It didn't matter. She said, "Right, and a Mühlenmeister was there." I nodded my head as if I understood what she was talking about, and then I went home and Wikipedia'd Anne de Mühlenmeister. She is a beautiful fashion designer who lives in Antwerp and is currently doing design inspired by Jackson Pollock. Of course she and Patti are friends. Patti Smith knew who I was. I shook her hand. Suddenly, I was transported back to Amsterdam. Time stretched and bent, and I went for a ride. I dare anyone to prove that I didn't. Places also help you time travel. My grandfather, Steve Millmore, was a wonderful man. We called him Gunka, and he was a Watertown, Massachusetts firefighter and served as a machine gunner in World War II. He married my grandmother, Helen, and went overseas for 5 years, until he came back and put his uniform in the attic and never spoke of his service again. He had 3 wonderful children, including my wonderful mother. He died of a heart attack on my front porch on July 4th, 1982, when he was only 65. I was 11. He was the first important person in my life to die, and when he did, it was the first time I realized that life is not fair or safe or even ours to own. I miss him. Gunka had a Wurlitzer organ, and he loved to play. His grandchildren would sit on his lap, and he would play Bing Crosby or Nat King Cole, lots of Christmas tunes. He wrote songs for us when we had the chicken pox. He went through his songbook and put numbers over the notes, and then made a corresponding chart on cardboard that he laid over the keys so we could play songs ourselves. For a while, I thought I was a genius and could totally play the organ. The reality was that I was the luckiest girl in the world because I had a grandfather who was a magic maker. Sitting on the organ bench was important. Now that I think of it, benches are cool, sacred by design. Benches are often a place where something special happens and important talks take place. Look at Forrest Gump, or Hoosiers, or outside a brunch place. Brunch benches are where it all goes down. After my Nana passed away in 2003, my family took Gunka's organ and put it in the basement of the house they shared, and it sat there for 10 years, waiting for its chance to travel. And now it lives in my apartment in New York City. My boys play it all the time. They sit on the same bench I sat on and feel the same good feelings of family and home. One night when I was feeling lonely and stressed, the organ started buzzing. I think Gunka was trying to talk to me. I sat on the bench and felt better. Inside the organ bench is old sheet music with my grandparents' handwriting. I also found a song that I wrote when I was 7. It's a poem that has numbers written above it, so it can be played the special way on my special organ. I wrote it in the past and put it in the sacred bench so I could pull it out at just the right time. Time is just time. Time travel, y'all. Here's what I found. It's a poem with numbers, but I think it's supposed to be a song, so I'm going to try to sing it and make up a tune. Have a nice day. Hope you have a nice day. I hope you aren't sad. It makes me feel bad to know that you're not glad. So please have a nice day today. Finally, things can help us time travel. A few summers ago, I was feeling sad. I was in Atlanta and went shopping in a vintage store. I don't love shopping for clothes. I just wish I could wear a daily uniform. As previously noted, I had to look up Anne de Mulemeester on Wikipedia. In the shop, I found an old-timey bathing suit. I brought the bathing suit home and I looked at it, and I thought about who might have owned it before. The bathing suit didn't fit into my life at that moment. I was too busy to go swimming. I felt disconnected from my body after having kids, and I was sad. I sat in the moment, looking at that bathing suit. I thought about how long my winter had been. My brain fooled me into thinking the winter would never end. I closed my eyes, and I thought of what my life would look like when it did finally end, what 6 months from now might feel like. I put this bathing suit in a drawer, and it waited for me to take it traveling. And then, 6 months later, I went to Palm Springs with a bunch of wonderful women. They were my beautiful friends who had helped me through a difficult year. We were going swimming, and I reached into my bag to find a bathing suit. And I had put this old-timey bathing suit in with the rest. I tried it on again, and I felt beautiful. I thanked the bathing suit for waiting for me. I got into the pool with Rashida and Catherine and Aubrey, and I thanked the women for holding me up when I couldn't hold myself. I thought about the woman who had worn that bathing suit before and realized she was another woman who had helped me. I thanked her, too. I realized I had traveled again, this time into a happier future. I stood in the sun. I thanked the sun. The more I time travel, the more I learn, I'm always just where I need to be. Obligatory drug stories, or lessons I learned on mushrooms. Growing up, my hometown was a drinking town. We all sneaked into our parents' liquor cabinets at an early age and spiked our hot chocolate for our high school football games. Alcohol was accessible and drinking was slightly encouraged. Every family had a funny Polaroid of their 5-year-old kid holding a beer. My parents weren't heavy drinkers, but they imbibed. I have fond memories of being 10 and handing my dad Budweisers as he played slow-pitch softball. Summer sunsets were spent on a dusty field as these men swung hard and spit in the dust and put us on their shoulders. It was a parade of mustaches and farmer tans. It was later that I realized those men were only in their early 30s and already married with children, a collection of young dads in their prime. My mother had her wine, which she didn't drink much of when we were young, but now that she's 67 and retired, she allows herself a glass or three. I loved playing bartender behind the big bar we had in our finished basement. It was next to our giant record player console and our faux leather couch and shiny floral wallpaper. The wall-to-wall carpeting went all the way up the 2 concrete poles that supported the house. I spent hours down there pretending I was Michael Jackson or dancing as the weather girls told me it was raining men. That basement was like my personal Copacabana, and when it was filled with my parents' friends, I would sit on the stairs and listen to the clink of their glasses and their bursts of laughter. I would make an excuse to pad down in my Holly Hobby nightgown and pretend I'd had a bad dream, all in an attempt to peep at the women with their shiny brown lipstick and the men packing their cigarettes against their hips. Then there were the bad parts. Too many kids in our town died from drinking and driving. At least once a year, there was a horribly sad funeral. Flowers would appear, tied up against some pole. Paper cups would spell out, "We miss you, Katie," in a chain-link fence at the entrance of our high school. I shudder to think of all the times I got into a car with someone who was wasted. Once, I was with my best friend, Carrie, and we were in the back seat of some ridiculous car, like a, I don't know, Iraq or Z40 or Miata 22. I don't know. I don't care about cars. Carrie had a crush on the driver, and he had brought his friend along. We were headed to Revere Beach to drive around and do nothing. And the boy was a little drunk and driving really fast, and I was screaming at him to slow down. And I was so angry, I kept thinking, I can't believe I'm going to die in this cheesy car with these two assholes with spray tans and names I don't even know. I am ashamed of the few times I drove drunk. Drinking and driving is the absolute worst. Because unlike doing coke in your basement while you teach yourself guitar, you could kill someone else. I think about the few times I drove drunk and I picture all of the beautiful families I passed in my car whose lives I could have taken. Please, don't drive drunk, okay? Seriously, it's so fucked up. But by all means, walk drunk. That looks hilarious. Everybody loves to watch someone act like they're trying to make it to safety during a hurricane. My town was good at supporting future drinking problems. Our parties consisted of kegs in the woods. The boys wore drinking gloves, and we played quarters with cups of beer. Wine coolers made their debut just around this time, and the sugary concoctions made it easier for teenage girls to get drunk. Being young means you have no sense of your own limits, so we would all drink like it was our last night on Earth. But even back then, I fantasized about what it would be like to drink socially, like Sue Ellen on Dallas. I would pour grape juice in wine glasses and sit in our fancy dining room arguing with myself. This was the beginning of a long life of attempting to be much older than I was. I was on search for the perfect amount of ennui. I would babysit while I watched 30-something, clucking out loud when the characters were failing to communicate. I was 16. Why did I care if Hope and Michael had another baby? I've tried most drugs, but avoided the big, bad ones. Meth never squirmed its way into my life, thank God. It is so evil and horrifying. But I'm not going to pretend that I'm not fascinated by the idea of staying up for days on end painting my basement. When I was 25 and living in Chicago, the building supers were two very polite and meticulous meth heads. Matt and I lived above them and listened to them constantly washing their floors. They also loved to vacuum. They often spent the night rearranging furniture and wiping down surfaces. More than once, I woke to the sound of them sweeping the porch steps, moving the same pile of dirt around and around. They were tough to talk to, almost impossible to understand and make eye contact with. But I had a strange affection for their ability to channel their meth-taking into real apartment improvements. The problems began once they started knocking on our door, claiming our sink was leaking. And then they would spend the whole day taking the sink apart. Then they would ask for $20 to go find a special sink part and disappear for a week. And then one of them died. So, all in all, meth seemed too risky. Heroin was another drug that didn't catch my tail. I lived in New York's East Village in 1998 when heroin was making its 45th comeback. The streets were filled with suburban junkies shooting up next to their pit bull puppies. My building was across from Tompkins Square Park, which had been suffering and or improving due to gentrification. And the apartments were filled with a lot of musicians and models living alone in New York City for the first time. Most of the models took a real liking to me. Tall women are attracted to my littleness. I have a lot of tall female friends. They like how I am always looking up to them, and I like having the option to jump into their pocket if I want to hide. One model, a Midwestern beauty I will call Hannah, met me at the mailboxes and told me she liked my sneakers. Not long after, she confessed she was having an affair with a very famous professional basketball player and asked if I would like to go to a game with her. She wouldn't tell me his name, but she mentioned he was the one you know. We sat courtside as the team warmed up, and this player made eye contact with us and nodded approvingly. "He likes when I bring girls to the game," she said. I didn't know exactly what that meant, but I did know that if that gentleman had put his penis inside me, I surely would have died. I couldn't stop thinking about his giant penis, and every time I looked at tall Hannah, I pictured the two of them having sex. A giant, pale oak tree getting penetrated by a dark, taller oak tree, their size 50 feet rubbing up against each other on some special bed built to hold their enormous bodies. The player would come visit her at night while his driver waited outside, black SUV idling. Hannah lived above me, and I would picture them fucking and then eventually breaking through the floor and crashing through my ceiling, killing us all with one giant official NBA penis. The fear of this encouraged me to move to a new apartment. That, and the one freezing morning I had to step over a passed-out model who had nodded off while filling out a W-2 form, only to open the outside door and find a giant pile of human shit. I said goodbye to the East Village and moved over to the West Village, where we don't have those kinds of problems. In the West Village, we just have tweaked-out gay hustlers who hit us over the heads with rocks. Thank you very much. I also didn't try heroin because I was told that everyone threw up the first time they did it, and I was never at a party where I felt like throwing up. When given the option to throw up or not throw up, I usually choose the latter. That being said, I am pretty good at making myself throw up, which I tried in high school when I watched my bulimic friends do it. I was lucky that habit didn't stick. Our school was riddled with beautiful girls who thought they were fat and ugly, anorexic girls who cut peanut M&Ms in half and climbed the stairs during lunch. Sometimes I think about those skinny girls and their rapid and hungry hearts, and I just want to put my hands on their chests and cry chocolate tears that they can lick and swallow. What else? I've never tried antidepressants. I probably should have after my first kid, when my postpartum blues felt deeper than I could handle. At the time, I thought I was just tired and sad, and I remember the flat defeat I felt when my doctor suggested I put on a dress and take in a Broadway show. I climbed out of that dark place, but rubbing shoulders with that depression made me keenly aware of the difference between being depressed and being depressed. Anxiety and depression are cousins, and I've had a few panic attacks in my adult life that knocked me off my game. The best way I can explain a panic attack is that it's the feeling of someone inside my body stacking it with books. The books continue to pile up, and they make me feel like I can't breathe. Meditation helps a lot. Sex does too. Calling someone equally as anxious on the phone makes you feel less alone. Sometimes the best thing to hear is not, "Don't worry, it's going to be okay," but actually, "Yeah, tell me about it. The whole world is going to explode, and I haven't slept for weeks. Now let me tell you about my specific fears of small boats and big business." As I've gotten older, my social anxiety has worsened. I'm not great in a crowd. I don't see a lot of rock shows because sometimes I'm just afraid I won't get out. I used to squeeze my little self into the scrum and jump around and cause tiny trouble. And now I just want to sit down and have someone perform my five favorite songs while I eat a light dinner and receive a simultaneous pedicure. Is there some kind of awesome indie alt hip hop electronica music tour that can do that? In my 20s, I tried cocaine, which I instantly loved but eventually hated. Cocaine is terrific if you want to hang out with people you don't know very well and play ping pong all night. It's bad for almost everything else. If you're wondering who's on coke, it's probably the last people left at the bar talking loudly about their strained relationships with their dads while the bartender closes up and puts stools on the tables. The day after cocaine is rough. Same with ecstasy. I remember a wonderful UCB New Year's Eve party where we all danced and drank water and loved each other. I also remember the next day when I thought I had no friends and I was so sad I wanted to sink into the carpet and permanently live there. The next day is the thing I can't pull off anymore. How do you explain to a 4- and 6-year-old that you can't play rescue bots because you have to spend all day in bed eating Cape Cod potato chips and watching The Bicycle Thief? We didn't take a lot of pills in my day, which was lucky. Those suckers are heart stoppers. It's scary today to see all those downers find their way into young people's hands. Teenage bodies should be filled with Vonnegut and meatball subs, not opiates that create glassy-eyed party monsters. But the pills aren't just for teens. There's a lot of middle-aged ladies who are thin and cranky, hanging on to their slurring husbands who can't make a fist. It's all kind of a mess, isn't it? But weed doesn't seem as bad. I know there are people who get addicted to marijuana. I don't want my kids to smoke it. I plan on lying to my children about most of my drug use. I had a friend who told her adolescent son he was allergic to pot, and if he tried it, he would break out into hives. This lasted for a while, until one of his friends gently suggested maybe she had made that fact up. His whole world was blown. He came to her asking, "Did you make that up? How could you?" And she said, "Of course I did. Let me make you a BLT. I think this is a terrific idea. I think we don't lie to our children enough. We also don't bribe them enough. It's a wonderful day when your child gets old enough to be bribed. It's a whole new tool in your arsenal. I plan on telling my children. I had a few drinks and a few joints, but the whole thing just seemed like it wasn't for me. Then I'm going to hire a private investigator to test their urine. I mean, it's not like they're going to read this book anytime soon. What's more boring than your own mother's take on her own life? Yawn. Also, I'm counting on everyone living on the moon by the time my children are teenagers, and that they'll have really interesting space friends who are kind and good students and think drugs are lame and totally, like, earthish. The first time I smelled pot was when I was a teenager and at a Bryan Adams concert. I thought to myself, that smells like my dad's car. I'm aware that some of you may be wondering what I was doing at a Bryan Adams concert. Try rocking out and buying neon shirts, dude. Anyway, I went home and searched all of my father's pockets and drawers until I found some weed. The revelation that my dad was a pot smoker wasn't too shocking. He was always friendly and happy. He loved getting to places early to pick us up and sitting in his car, and he was always first to suggest we get ice cream in the middle of the day. I had some friends with alcoholic parents, and my memories of those houses always involved people being scared, afraid of what mood was around the corner. I never worried about my father and how he would act around my friends. He was generous and nice and didn't yell. He sort of whacked me once when I was being a straight-up bitch about wanting to wear my mom's coat. He surprised himself, and I burst out crying, and he apologized long into the night, and I milked it for as long as I could. But I knew, even at 15, that he was under a lot of pressure, and I was just being a spoiled brat. High school and college came and went, and I smoked pot very rarely. Then I arrived in Chicago and lived the life of a stoner for a year. I would smoke in the morning and listen to Bob Marley. I would wear headphones and buy records and comic books. I would make mac and cheese while watching Deep Space Nine. I'm not one of those people who smokes weed and suddenly has a burst of creativity. I'm one of those people who smokes weed and spends an hour lightening my eyebrows. It slowed me down, and it helped with my Irish stomach and anxiety and the constant channel changing that happened in my head. I can't perform, drive, or write stoned, and therefore I smoke pot a lot less than I used to. Gone are the days when I could walk to 7-Eleven and play the game, buy the weirdest two things. So, to sum up, drugs suck. They ruin people's lives. They kill people too early. They destroy hopes and dreams and tear families apart. Drugs help. They pull people from despair. They balance our moods and minds and keep us from freaking out on airplanes. Drugs are fun. They expand our horizons. They create great memories and make folding our laundry bearable. And before I leave you, here are some quick lessons I learned on mushrooms. Good things. Everyone needs love. Never hurt a living thing. Don't worry about the choices you make because everything will be fun because life is a closet filled with pool toys. And Neil Young can read your mind. Here are the bad things. Your face will get old. We are all alone. Sometimes benches move. And Neil Young can read your mind.
Strangers should be a little strange. I don't know you, fool.
My boys. I'm a moon junkie. Every time I look at the moon, I feel less alone and less afraid. I tell my boys that moonlight is a magic blanket, and the stars above us are campfires set by friendly aliens. I track lunar cycles on my iPhone and take my kids out at night when a moon is new or full or blue. We call this moon hunting, and we bring flashlights and moon candy along. The moon candy looks suspiciously like M&Ms, but so far neither one of my sons has noticed. On moon hunting nights, I give them a bath and rub both of my boys down with a vino lotion and comb their hair. I spread Aquaphor on my lips and I try to kiss them. Sometimes I chase them around until I catch one of them and throw him on the bed like a bag of laundry. Most times, I'm too tired. Then we head outside. We wear pajamas, because going outside at night in your pajamas feels like you're breaking out of jail. I watch their little fat feet and their shiny cheeks as they jump into the backseat of the car. These boys, they are delicious. I swear, if I could eat my children, I would. I'd consume them like some beast in a Hieronymus Bosch painting, but in a friendlier, more mom-like way. Their little bodies make me salivate. It takes everything I have not to swallow them whole. During one full moon, I announced my plans to drive to an open field and have us climb into our sleeping bags and howl at the night sky. As we drove to my pre-planned spot, my boys once again reminded me to stay in the moment and stop overthinking. They kept pointing to the huge moon, shouting, "Mama, it's right there! We don't have to drive to the moon! It came to us!" We pulled over just a few blocks from our Los Angeles home and abandoned my previous plan. I spread out a blanket and we snuggled together, our bodies on the warm hood of the car. The hood was slippery, so we used our bare feet for traction. We all made wishes. I wished that my children would be kind and happy, and I would wake up with a flatter stomach. Archie wished that everyone in the world was a robot. Abel wished for more Legos. They are my boys. My boys. My Archie boy. My baby Abel. My boy Archie has the eyes the color of blueberries. He has a solid sense of design and is only months away from his first cartwheel. When he was just 2 weeks old, his dad and I took a picture of him in his crib with the New York Times draped over him like a blanket. The headline read, "Obama, racial barrier falls in decisive victory." He loves to run and strongly identifies with Luke Skywalker because they have the same hair. He recently told me, "Mama, you want to know something funny about me? I'm afraid of little things and not afraid of big things." I think he was talking about bugs and elephants, but I understood what he meant in a very deep way. He deals primarily in poop and fart jokes and insists these things will never fail to make him laugh. He is absolutely right. He's delighted when I laugh at him, but he is no ham. He's sensitive and stubborn, and as of this printing, would like to be a police officer and a veterinarian and also Iron Man. He once asked me, "Are you sad that you don't have a penis?" I told him that I was happy with the parts that I had. I then reminded him that girls have vaginas and everyone is different and each body is like a snowflake. He nodded in agreement and then looked up at me with a serious face and asked, "But did you once have a penis and break it?" I was tempted to make a joke that would screw him up for life. "Yes, my son, your mother once had a penis, but it broke because you didn't love her enough." The bond between mothers and sons is powerful stuff, man. I firmly believe that every boy needs his mom to love him and every girl needs her dad to pay attention to her. Archie needed to figure out if I had ever owned and operated a penis. I get it. His penis is important to him. Anyway, he starts college next year. Just kidding. He's 6. He recently asked me if he could marry me, and I said yes. I couldn't help it. I would marry him anytime. My boy Abel has eyes the color of a pine forest. He's a red monkey who named himself. I went to a psychic before he was born, and she told me I was having another big boy, and he wants to be called Abel. We agreed. As he was born, the song Young Turks played on the radio, and Rod Stewart sang, "Young hearts be free tonight. Time is on your side." Abel has chocolate chip freckles and hair like a copper penny. He loves to dance and sing, and recently composed a song called "I Am a Genius." He's a big hugger. He doesn't mind when I stick my head into his neck and smell him. He smells like a love cookie. He recently told me he really likes it when girls wear nice blouses. He has a deep laugh, and he thinks Darth Vader is funny. He cries big tears and sweats in his sleep. He makes friends on airplanes. He is 4. The first thing he does when he wakes up in the morning is look for Archie. He loves his big brother so intensely. His big brother protects him and tortures him. Abel feels like the wisest and oldest member of our family. When he was just starting to talk, he used to ask me if I was happy. He has dreams that he is a different little boy with black hair and one eye. My beautiful Tibetan nanny, Dawa, believes he has been reincarnated many times. When I was pregnant with Abel, Archie and I used to take naps together. We spent part of that summer in Nantucket, and every afternoon we would snuggle together as the breeze blew in. I was holding one baby on the inside and one on the outside. I count those naps as some of the happiest times in my life. I imagined a peaceful and quiet life with my two boys. I pictured kissing their heads as they obediently put themselves to bed, as in a John Irving novel. I was so stupid. Everything is loud now. My guys need to touch each other all the time. They wrestle and bump and yank. They play like lion cubs, rolling around until one of them decides to bite. They jump off couches and they buzz around on scooters. They swing sticks and tell people, "Food goes into your stomach and turns into poop." They love dinosaurs and superheroes and sounding like both. And everything is physical and visual, and feelings are expressed by karate kicks. I love my boys so much, I fear my heart will explode. I wonder if this love will crack open my chest and split me in half. It is scary, this love. I should point out here that I have a picture of them wearing underwear on their heads while simultaneously pooping. Archie's on the toilet and Abel's on a potty, and they're facing each other and smiling like crazy people. I plan on using it for blackmail when they're teenagers and won't let me hug them in public anymore. When your children arrive, the best you can hope for is that they break open everything about you. Your mind floods with oxygen. Your heart becomes a room with wide open windows. You laugh hard every day. You think about the future and read about global warming. You realize how nice it feels to care about someone else more than yourself. And gradually, through this heart-heavy openness and these fresh eyes, you start to see the world a little more. Maybe you start to care a teeny tiny bit more about what happens to everyone in it. Then, if you're lucky, you meet someone who gently gestures for you to follow her down a path that allows you to feel a little less gross about how many advantages you've had in your life. I was lucky. I met Jane. Dr. Jane Aronson and I were at a fancy party thrown by Glamour magazine when we fell in love. We were both being given a Glamour Woman of the Year award. This type of award is really nice to win, and also slightly embarrassing. It's hard to be surrounded by women who stood up against a totalitarian regime and talk to them about my experiences writing sketches where a girl farts a lot. Before the party, I Googled Dr. Jane and read about all her great work transforming the lives of orphaned children all over the world. As I sat in my seat and stared at Rihanna's gorgeous extraterrestrial face, I flipped through that evening's program and I learned that Jane had founded the Worldwide Orphans Foundation, which addresses the medical, social, and educational needs of children living in orphanages in over 11 countries. But it wasn't until I heard Jane speak that the abstract idea of her work became real. She spoke plainly and openly about how every child in the world deserves the basic things in life: food, clothes, safety, shelter, and love. She was joined on stage by many orphans whose lives she had changed. She cried, I cried, we all cried. Then Bill Clinton introduced Maya Angelou, and I thought to myself, what the fuck am I doing here? After the event, there was a loud party filled with famous people, and this is going to sound like a real douchebag thing to say, but I've been to a lot of parties with famous people, and they aren't that great. Famous people are never as interesting as your friends. Parties with a lot of famous people usually get crowded. I tend to feel plain and over or underdressed. I get nervous. I don't like crowds because I'm small and fear being trampled. My ideal night out is a dinner party in my backyard with a group of like-minded friends whom I boss around in a gentle and loving way. Jane is bossy and socially uncomfortable in just the same way, and so naturally we started talking. Let me take a minute to say that I love bossy women. Some people hate the word, and I understand how bossy can seem like a shitty way to describe a woman with a determined point of view. But for me, a bossy woman is someone to search out and celebrate. A bossy woman is someone who cares and commits and is a natural leader. And even though I'm bossy, I like being told what to do by people who are smarter and more interesting than me. Jane asked me to host her next event. She spoke about her travels all over the world. I told her I would love to do that someday, and she said, okay then, we will. I hosted an event for her the next year, and we became friends. Then she took me to Haiti a year after, as she'd promised. At the end of 2012, I was in the middle of separating from my husband and preparing to host the Golden Globes for the first time. I felt completely sorry for myself while simultaneously believing I was hot shit. I spent a melancholy but sweet New Year's Eve with my wonderful friends John and Jen and Meredith and Tom and Rachel and Marco. We went to see Sleep No More, an epic NYC masquerade ball. I watched a beautiful dance piece as the clock struck midnight and was mesmerized by a young dancer who looked like Natalie Portman. At one point, she touched my shoulder, and I wondered if I should have sex with girls for a while. I was all over the place. My life was an open suitcase, and my clothes were strewn all over the street. I was happy to be wearing a mask that night because I didn't have any idea who I was. Great things were happening in my career, and my personal life had exploded. I was trapped in an awful spiral of insecure narcissism. I was nervous and excited to go to Haiti with Jane, if only for a change of scenery. When relationships end, it's hard at first to stay in a setting you used to share. No one wants to be the cat scratching at the door that won't open. And so, I boarded a plane bound for Haiti on New Year's Day, 2013. I was traveling with Jane and her colleague, Noah Gonzalez, along with a few others. When asked if this was anyone's first visit to a third world country, a 14-year-old girl named Grace and I raised our hands. I made note of this. On the flight, Jane spoke casually about Haiti and its challenges. It was a country filled with young people. 65% of the country was under 20 years old. And many Haitians died from diseases like hypertension and asthma. There are over 700 orphanages in Haiti, and there are over 430,000 orphans. On top of all that, the earthquake, a country with a battered and bruised infrastructure, had just suffered a devastating earthquake. It sounded like there was so much to fix. It sounded overwhelming. I sat on the plane and listened to music. I wondered if I was just doing this as some sort of ego trip, and then I decided I didn't care. Not enough is made of the fact that being of service makes you feel good. I think nonprofits should guarantee that giving your time and money makes your skin better and your ass smaller. Why not? There are so many people in the world with so little. Who cares why you decide to help? We navigated the busy Port-au-Prince airport, and I felt very white and very tired. I felt like I was in a movie where the divorcee tries to turn her life around. It felt like a cliche, and I was angry that my head was filled with what felt like such self-indulgent bullshit. We met our driver, a young and handsome Haitian man. I thought about trying to have sex with him, but did the math and figured the rest of the week would be too awkward once he had gently turned me down. Then I fantasized about him changing his mind and knocking on my door late at night. Then I realized I was in Haiti and not paying attention. He leaned over, smiled, and said, "Welcome to Haiti. You might love it or you might hate it, but you will never forget it." I decided I would have sex with him if he so desired. My first impression was of total chaos. The streets of Port-au-Prince were filled with dust and trash and babies. There was so much to look at. Everyone was busy carrying something. A man had a tray of hamburgers on his head. Women were trucking their laundry through the streets as young children pulled heavy pots of water. The roads were twisted and full of debris. It looked like someone had picked up Haiti, held it upside down, and shaken it. It felt unmoored. I understood the feeling. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not some crazy white girl who's comparing her divorce to the problems of the Haitian people. All I'm saying is it felt totally chaotic and therefore familiar to my brain. We passed a group of handsome young boys hanging out on dirt bikes. I thought of Sinead O'Connor's song, Black Boys on Mopeds, and then I thought of Sinead O'Connor ripping up the picture of the Pope, and then I thought about writing jokes for famous people, and then I wondered if I should ask the Haitian driver to be my date at the Golden Globes. Then I snapped back to the present and remembered where I was. Style is obviously important in Haiti, and a lot of people wore bright colors and neatly pressed shirts. The taxis and billboards were beautiful. Haiti is not afraid of color and texture and depth. The young people looked fierce and bored. They looked like pure energy. There was a true aesthetic, but also a palpable darkness. I mean, let's get real. Kids are slaves there. Kids are bought and sold and put to work. I saw Haitian boys with bodies the same sizes as Archie's and Abel's carrying huge jugs of water. In just a few minutes, you could tell which kids had parents and which were on their own. I kept trying to connect the small children and the adults they were walking next to. I was looking for comfort. I was uncomfortable. You know that horrible feeling when you lose your kid for a minute in a mall and your heart pounds and your ears fill with blood? It was that feeling. When I drove the streets of Haiti, it felt like many of the children I saw were lost, and no one was looking for them. I kept peeking at Jane to see if she saw what I saw, but she was only concerned with what was ahead. We visited one of WWO's toy libraries. They're rooms filled with donated toys that are organized according to developmental stages. All the toys were beautifully kept and displayed, and the room smelled like vinegar. We all sat in a circle and sang Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. I held an adorable little girl, and I kept instinctually looking to hand her off to her mother until I realized she didn't have one. We drove up to Kenskoff, which was a mountainous and much greener part of Haiti. It reminded me of Haiti's rich and fancy cousin, the Dominican Republic, and how places so close could also be so far apart. We hiked up a hillside, and I felt old. I sent emails to my assistant about the Golden Globes with subject headings like, "Yes to the fake teeth." We arrived at an open field filled with young Haitian WWO volunteers. They wore matching shirts, and they led the kids in what looked like improv games. They sang and danced as each kid was encouraged to commit to looking ridiculous. Some of the boys were playing soccer, and Jane tied her long-sleeve shirt around her waist and joined them. I realized there was no getting out of physical activity, so I sashayed over to a small amplifier and started to DJ. A dance party broke out. The kids laughed at me at first, until they realized I'm a world-class dancer with moves of steel. I was exhausted in 10 minutes. Some other children were painting bricks. I imagined the bricks were going to be used for something, but no one told me what. Most of these children were used to living in the moment. Thinking about the future was a luxury. They took turns with their paintbrushes. There was no crying about sharing. There was no pushing or saying they were bored. Everybody was used to waiting. I met girls with names like Jenica and Suzenny, and when I said their names out loud, it felt like I had jewels in my mouth. One girl told me her nickname was Sexy. She couldn't have been 12, and I worried about who had given her that name. A weird sandstorm kicked up, and the dust swirled like a magic trick. We all paused together to watch, and I took a mental picture and time traveled to the future. I thought about my boys being teenagers and playing soccer and dancing and sharing. In Kenskoff, we ate dinner and heard stories from WWO supervisors. Melissa was a soft-spoken blonde who knew perfect Creole and worked in West Africa with the Peace Corps. Her funny partner, Wendy, came from Michigan by way of Uganda and Kenya. Wendy spoke with what I would call a world accent, and she and Melissa told the story of meeting during the Haitian earthquake. Falling in love among the aftershocks, it sounded so romantic. And I wondered if Anderson Cooper had ever fallen in love during an earthquake. Then, for the 100th time that week, I wished I were a lesbian. Melissa and Wendy told us a story about a woman in Haiti who used to dress up like a nun and collect donations for her orphanage. She was not a sister of God, and the place she ran sounded like a jail. Melissa cozied up to her until she was finally allowed access inside. The children there were malnourished and dying. Some had rat bites. Girls were being sold into prostitution. WWO brought in toys and youth volunteers. They surreptitiously counted the children as they sang songs with them. They estimated there were at least 65 kids in danger in that horrible place. Melissa and Wendy spoke to anyone who listened about the terrible conditions until the police and UNICEF intervened. The woman threatened them with voodoo, which is no joke in Haiti. Wendy and Melissa scrambled to find placement for all the kids, and on the day they were taken out of that nightmare, there were WWO workers waiting in a line so each child had a lap to sit on. That evil woman went to jail. In just 1 month after he was rescued from her care, one little guy named Shashu went from being a nonverbal boy with a distended belly to being a butterball who loved to sing. People are very bad and very good. A little love goes a long way. The hardest day in Haiti for me was when we visited a few orphanages. Some of these places were doing the best they could, and others had a long way to go. Jane's colleague Noah and I saw babies living in cribs that looked like cages. A little boy named Woolsey jumped into Noah's arms and wouldn't let go. He was desperate for attachment, and men were especially scarce. Woolsey held on to Noah like a bramble. We were filled with anxiety because we knew we would have to say goodbye. Noah had to drop him back off at his crowded room, and Woolsey hung on and started to get upset. He finally got down and faced a corner as he cried. It was the loneliest thing I've ever seen. A teacher went to him, but it barely comforted him. These kids needed so much holding, kisses and hugs and clothes and parents. They needed everything, and the enormity of what they needed was so intense. We ended up talking in the street with Jane and crying. Jane was agitated and passionate. She talked about all the work left to do and all the small changes that can improve children's lives. I was once again moved by her ability to steer into the curve. Jane was a big wave rider. She didn't make the mistake that most of us make, which is to close our eyes and hope the waves will go away or miss us or hit someone else. She dove in, head first. That night, I read the deeply calm and at times sneakily funny Pema Chodron, one of my favorite writers. There are no promises. Look deeply at joy and sorrow, at laughing and crying, at hoping and fearing, at all that lives and dies. What truly heals is gratitude and tenderness. Pema reminded me to practice Tonglen, which is this meditation breathing exercise where you breathe in all of the pain and breathe out nothing but love. It felt like the opposite of what I had been doing for a year. I felt one tiny molecule in the bottom of my heart feel better. I heard dogs fucking outside my window and wondered if I should try to find my Haitian driver. I emailed Tina about her Mandy Patinkin bit. On our last night, we went to the Hotel Montana, which had started rebuilding after the earthquake. One of the owners, Goethe, spoke of how she had survived, and her sister Nadine had been pulled out of the rubble. I later read in the Washington Post that her sister was trapped for days and found by a beagle that caught her scent. The rescuers brought over her son, who called to her and said, "I think that is my mother down there." She was pulled out days later. In the same article, Goethe says that Nadine had been kidnapped in Haiti a few years ago and held for 15 days. "You have no idea what it takes to survive here," Goethe said. I knew she had a very good idea. Goethe also talked about travel. She talked about living in Jamaica. She joked about her husband and her haircut because she is more than the earthquake. A person's tragedy does not make up their entire life. A story carves deep grooves into our brains each time we tell it. But we aren't one story. We can change our stories. We can write our own. Melissa and Wendy and Jane and I joked about the Golden Globes and gave each other fake awards. I gave Melissa Best Person in Charge, and she gave me Most Famous and Most Normal. This meant and means a great deal. Later that night, we talked about animals. Wendy shared a story about how her daughter was caught in a stampede of elephants and lived to tell about it because she ran left instead of right. And because she knew one simple fact: elephants leave the way they come in. This reminded me of something I read, that your divorce will be like your marriage. We all agreed that elephants win for coolest animal, and I showed off by reciting my elephant facts. Elephants have long pregnancies and purr like cats to communicate. They cry, pray, and laugh. They grieve. They have greeting ceremonies when one of them has been away for a long time. I thought of this when I got back to my boys, the elephants and the greeting ceremonies. I told them about how one day we might ride an elephant, and they climbed on each other to act it out, switching parts halfway through. I gave them a bath and put lotion on their skin. I realized how lucky my life is. And theirs. I lay in bed and thought about time and pain. and how many different people live under the same big, beautiful moon.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage Amy Poehler!